It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
My name is Travis View. I'm the co-host of the QAnon Anonymous podcast, where we've been following the development and growth of the QAnon movement over the past few years.
So, you know, a lot of the people that listen to this show either identify as or are involved in anti-fascist politics, right? I mean, that's kind of a pretty common demographic. We were talking a bit before we started recording about this sort of fascination that I think all of us share on the show about, you know, really absurd ways of thinking like QAnon. But what is it about QAnon that people should be taking seriously, right? So it's really easy to look at it and go, face switching and George Soros and all this stuff is all completely ridiculous. But why should people really be paying attention?
Yeah, I really think that QAnon should be of interest to anti-fascists because it's essentially viral fascism. It's a way to leverage social media and the way the internet functions in order to spread fascist propaganda more effectively. I mean, it makes the radicalization process very engaging and gamified. So a lot of people don't even really realize that that's happening, even if they would otherwise perhaps recoil at sort of being associated with fascist ideology or Nazism. It allows them to sort of live in this alternate fantasy world in which they are, and willingly or not, at the very least, close allies of fascists. I mean, these are people who crave a military dictatorship, and they are organizing both online and real life. And so I think that, you know, often I think the patently absurd things that they believe can distract from the ugliness of their goals. You know, we talk about, you know, who Jewish space lasers, and we talk about, you know, JFK Jr. lives and these other goofball things that they believe. And I think they're ridiculous. I think they're fine to laugh at because they're this is really too much to expect me to not laugh at JFK Jr. secretly alive and is helping Trump take down the deep state. It's ludicrous. But the ludicrousness of that, I don't think should distract from the fact that these are fascists who are organizing, who want to end American democracy as we know it and sweep away all of their enemies in the violent day of reckoning. So they often don't want to do it themselves necessarily. They fantasize that the military, someone's going to do it for them, but they want some, their goals are authoritarian.
As an aside to that, so much of conspiracy theories, even like stuff like QAnon, like it comes in sort of the language of, you know, a conspiracy of elites. Like it's talking about people supposedly on the top of society and like getting rid of them. So, but to be clear, like there's no liberatory aspect to QAnon. Like there's no like democratic veneer of what these people are talking about. It is like an authoritarian worldview ultimately that comes out of what they're promoting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, they're not shy about it either. I mean, they really want Daddy Trump to just remove everyone they hate from the highest levels of, you know, entertainment and politics and the media, so they don't have to deal with them anymore. And they don't care if that comes in a very violent or anti-democratic way.
Is there any fleshing out of like what the world looks like after that happens? Is it just that Trump is a dictator for life? And
oh, and then we live in utopia. You know, this is no. It's a utopian ideal. Is that they imagine that after this brutal, hideous crackdown, then we're going to live in this place of incredible wealth and health and like all of they often believe sometimes in secret cures, the idea that the deep state has been suppressing cures, and all the magic cures will come forward, and we'll have access to free energy that they believe mistakenly that Tesla invented, or they believe that we'll just have the incredible wealth and mobility and peace and togetherness. And so it's ultimately authoritarian, but also, like all fascist ideologies, it's a utopian kind of ideology.
I think a lot of people that listen to the show can definitely tie the thread between Pizzagate and QAnon, right? Like that thread is very, very clear. But in a recent episode of your podcast, you start diving into Chan culture a bit. And so there's this immediate roots of Q, right? This sort of Chan culture, troll culture leading into Pizzagate, leading into QAnon. But where are you seeing these sort of ideological roots, like outside of internet culture, right? Outside of, trolling and people sort of pushing forward misinformation and, the insider anon kind of phenomena that happened sort of around Trump's election. Where are the followers of this pulling their ideological threads from?
That's a really great question. I think that, the roots of the sort of the QAnon ideology are obviously a lot older. I mean, you could trace them to the protocols of the Elders of Zion, this early 20th century forgery, which claimed to be essentially how the Jews were kind of plotting to take control of the world, and that the idea is that they were controlling every element of society. QAnon also involves a kind of anti-Semitic blood libel and their belief in adrenochrome, which they think is the adrenalized blood of children, which they use to keep young, and the elites use supposedly to stay young in order to get high. A lot of this stuff is borrows from ancient conspiracist themes and themes that frankly have always been kind of part of American political culture, like forever. You go back to the early 19th century, the very first third party in the United States was the Anti-Masonic Party, which was this conspiracist single issue party, which believed that the Freemasons were planning to take control of the country and the world. They did very well. There were a couple of anti-Masonic governors, and at their peak of power, they controlled 10% of the House of Representatives. Moving through the 20th century, we had the Know Nothing Party in the late 19th century, and then the 20th century we had the rise of like McCarthyism and the John Birch Society. There's always been this conspiratorial undercurrent which plays upon the same themes, which are often anti-immigrant, anti-Semitic. But I think they were emboldened by the election of Donald Trump, who is our most conspiracist president. So the thing about conspiracism is that, you always have to go one layer deeper, even more conspiratorial. And when Trump gained power, that version was QAnon, which like I said, drew from Chan culture, but also a long tradition of American conspiracism.
Yeah. Well, and so I think a lot of what we've been tracing on the show are some of the threads of that, but also where those threads are leading, right? So like one of the things we've been noticing about QAnon is it's bleeding out into other elements of the right wing now. And it's kind of become, after the 6th, right, neo-Nazis were in QAnon Telegram channels, like openly recruiting people based on anti-Semitism, right? And you're also now starting to see the March 4th phenomena rise, which is really a sovereign citizen theory. But one of the things that's been specifically fascinating to me about QAnon, and I'm sort of really interested to hear your thoughts on this. QAnon started off as, an extension of Pizzagate and has become what is essentially an eschatological, like millenarian cult, right? Where did that end of the worldism happen, right? That's one of the threads that I myself have had a hard time tracing, is where all of a sudden it went from we're really scared about like pedophile Satanists eating our children and became, we're going to fight. The world is ending. It's going to end on January 20th and now March 4th. And then MAGA utopia is going to happen, right? Like where did it take on the millenarianism all of a sudden?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. I think that, Well, here's what's really unique about QAnon is that most conspiracy theories, they're pretty despairing, and they envision that there's this incredibly powerful entity that's plotting to control the world. They're often extremely clever, or they're currently controlling the world. The only sort of us regular people are very much powerless against this super powerful, incredibly competent enemy. However, QAnon sort of supposes the existence of an equal and opposite force to these evil conspirators. In this case, it's QT and the patriots who are engaging in them. So all of a sudden we have, you know, a Godzilla versus Mothra kind of situation where the white hats on the forces of Q Team and Trump and the patriots at their Facebook pages are doing battle with the forces of like evil and the cabal and Hillary Clinton and George Soros. And so it envisions that, it also assures the participants that that victory will come, right? That this, there is a force for good that's battling the conspiracy forces, and their victory is assured. And so they don't really think that they're uncovering the conspiracy so much. Is that they assume the conspiracy, and they know that. They assume that they're uncovering the details about the plan to destroy the conspiracy theory. In that sense, they're kind of figuring out what exactly Q Team and Trump is doing behind the scenes to assure their certain victory against the conspirators. And this kind of thinking, I think, naturally lends itself to apocalyptic thinking. They imagine, they essentially are envisioning a battle of Armageddon, of good versus evil. So yeah, I think that's kind of where it comes from.
Yeah, and I mean, you heard a lot of that in interviews with people leaving the Capitol on the 6th, right? This whole idea that they were going to go destroy demons, and that by destroying these demons, they were going to, you know, inaugurate the world of good. I mean, it sounds very evangelical, right? Like, the narrative is very evangelical in that sense, right? So, I mean, I know in my own family, the only person in my own family that has fallen hard for Q was an evangelical Christian before this, right? And I've heard that sort of narrative time and time again. Yeah, it's really fascinating. I think the other thing that I'm really starting to trace, and mentioned it briefly just before, is the way that QAnon is starting to essentially eat everything else on the right wing right now. And there's like Q adherence everywhere, but how those other threads are starting to influence what's going on in Q world. And so, you know, we had January 20th happen, right? We had January 6th happen. The storm didn't happen. We had January 20th happen. The storm didn't happen. Now they're trying to explain why, right? And I've heard the face switching theory, which is, of course, patently absurd, but also kind of entertaining to listen to. There's also the secret Trump pulling the strings theory, right? But the March 4th theory is unique, right? The March 4th theory is one of these things that, unless you're really studying the right wing, you've never heard of before and have no real reason to understand. So what is the March 4th theory, and where is that coming from? And what does that really tell us about where Q's going from here?
So the March 4th theory is actually borrowed by kind of bizarre logic from the sovereign citizen movement. And the sovereign citizen movement are these people who essentially believes that the federal government, as it stands, is illegitimate. They believe in this alternate legal system of what they call common law, or sometimes constitutional law. There's often, if you can sort of see very funny videos of sovereign citizens trying to argue their way out of a traffic ticket or something by using these absolutely ineffective legal strategies. But these people, sovereign citizens, they essentially believe that the United States was turned into a corporation in 1871, and therefore is no longer a country. And this allowed it to be basically taken over by shadowy financial forces, so that they own the federal government. And we kind of like give up, they believe that we give up our rights by participating in government functions, like getting a zip code or getting a driver's license or something like that. And so one of the side effects of their beliefs is that they think that all amendments essentially after the 14th Amendment are totally invalid. And this includes the 20th Amendment, which set the current inauguration date of January 20th. Prior to this, it was March 4th. And so as a result, they believe that that Donald Trump is coming to restore the republic back to the before we became a corporation in 1871. And he's going to be inaugurate our 19th president on March 4th of the restored republic. So this is troublesome. Like you point out, it's very troubling that QAnon, this internet popular conspiracy theory, is borrowing arguments from other older conspiratorial movements.
It's interesting that there seems to be a split in the conspiracy world. There always seems to be people that are arguing this kind of like legalistic, like, I found this one thing in the Constitution, like, this kind of gives us this loophole. And then there seems to be people that have gone a step beyond that, and their argument is essentially like, well, we don't need that kind of legalistic framework. Like, we're out of the bounds of the law now. We've entered into the state of exception where either state violence or fascist violence is okay to achieve our goals. Like, for instance, the QAnon shaman guy or whatever, you know, his whole thing when he was interviewed, when he came out of the Capitol, he said, like, you know, we're here to make sure that they uphold the laws of the Constitution. So he was like framing all the things that they did, like, in terms of like, well, this is just a legalistic thing that we're doing. Like, we're here to enforce the law as opposed to, like, you know, we're here to cause chaos and stop this vote from happening because we want, you know, this president to stay in power.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's true. I think obviously what's going on here is that they want, you know, the state violence to quickly solve their problems first and foremost, and they come up with rationalizations for that afterwards. I mean, the thing about the sovereign citizen movement is unique. And I often asked people, it's like, why exactly why don't they just simply claim that they are anarchists? Why don't they just say that, listen, I just don't recognize any legal framework whatsoever, therefore your laws don't apply to me? It seems like it'd be a lot less work than simply developing these convoluted legal theories. And the reason is that they really want to see themselves as law-abiding citizens. They want to see themselves as people who are really functioning well and properly within the system. But at the same time, they see the system as corrupt. And this creates a kind of like a tension, you know. It's like I'm a good person. I follow the laws of our democracy. I've been brought up to believe that's what a good person does. But at the same time, I hate the system so much. And so they resolve this by coming up with these alternate convoluted theories, or like the Q Shaman says, like he thought that he was only storming the Capitol probably to make Pence unilaterally. Dismiss electoral votes, which he of course doesn't really have the power to do. But so they wanted to have a vision of themselves as people who are very strictly adhering to the Constitution, and this allows them to not see themselves as extremists or radicals.
I think there is a reason why they don't want to call themselves anarchists. I mean, and as a show that identifies with the anarchist tradition, I think it's important to point that out. It's because anarchism is about getting rid of systems of domination and hierarchy to create more freedom, more cooperation, more equality. And I think that that's the exact opposite of what they want. Is they want this kind of immense return to traditional quote-unquote hierarchies and ultimately massive state power. So I think it's good that they don't call themselves anarchists, because they're not. You know, they don't want anarchism. They want this authoritarian state, which is the exact opposite. But I think that it's true, and we'll continue to talk about this, you know, the drive and embrace of state violence and fascist violence is becoming more and more apparent.
Yeah, and so one of the arguments I myself have made, and a lot of people around us have made, is this sort of connection to this tradition that they consider to be a true America. Right. You see this in the John Birch Society. You definitely see this in, you know, Barry Goldwater and then later David Duke, like people like this and that ilk. Right. David Duke ran on the Make America Great Again slogan like years and years ago. And after September 11th, that process became very weaponized. Right. With this sort of call by the state to participate in counterterrorism. Right. As like individuals. And it created this kind of citizen soldier mentality that we're really, really seeing kind of show up in the streets and like the guys of 3%ers, Oath Keepers, groups like this, right? And that kind of bleed over into sovereign citizens. I think one of the things that's terrifying about that for people like myself, and this is really important when it comes down to what we're going to see from Q next is we're starting to see this sort of factionalization on the right. And in that factionalization, kind of like in the mid-90s, you're seeing these sort of bubbles of extremism really build up, right? These sort of little tiny echo chambers within the larger right-wing echo chamber, and they're sort of fueling each other, right? And in that space, anyone that's deemed an enemy is a target, right? You're an internal enemy, you're disloyal to the state, you're not a true American, you're a target, right? And so we've seen this play out. I think one of the biggest questions I would love to hear thoughts on, you know, we talk about sovereign citizens. They have a history of violence, right? Often against police, but there is a history of sovereign citizen violence. When we talk about Christian dominionists, right? People like Michael Flynn, right? Or Matt Shea over in Oregon, right? Who are very prominent on January 6th. They also very clearly have a history of violence and are, you know, religious fascists, like they're theocrats, right? And they're not shy about that. The whole call for martial law, the call for rounding up opponents, right? After the election. What do you see, you know, and the eschatology, right? The millenarianism, the desperation that you're starting to see really build up in Q circles. Where is that going? Like, are we going to see people go full-blown suicide bomber? Like, what's happening in those circles? And what is the likelihood of us seeing relatively consistent political violence from those circles for the next series of years?
Yeah, is certainly possible. I mean, I talk about this with some other extremism reporters that what is the possibility of QAnon suicide bombers? You know, the thing is that I feel like the danger of QAnon is more apparent when you think of it more in the broader context of the far right ecosystem, because mm-hmm. What's interesting about QAnon followers is that they often don't think that they have to go out and do the violence themselves. I think this is a big part of QAnon, is that it allows you to, if you sympathize with the far right, but you think like you don't really want to have to pick up a gun and do it yourself, this might be very appealing to you. So as a consequence, they serve a few purposes. Number one, I think they serve as kind of cannon fodder for the far right because they are such zealots. We saw this in the form of Ashley Babbitt, who is a QAnon follower who stormed the Capitol, was the only person actually who was shot by Capitol Police and died. And of course, this is a casualty that I think the far right more broadly is willing to accept, more so than say a militia member who is a little bit more tactical about what they're doing. So there's that, and QAnon followers are also very helpful for generally spreading quasi anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, which is helpful to some segments of the far right. There is also, of course, there are also prime recruits into other more extreme, more militant versions of far right, you know, extremism. You mentioned this before, the ways in which not neo-Nazis are openly sort of recruiting QAnon followers. So the thing about QAnon followers is that, yeah, they are in many ways, I think, useful idiots. And I think their biggest dangers are more apparent when you consider the ways in which other kinds of extremists use them.
Well, and in some ways, that's kind of the roots, right? I mean, the whole insider and non-phenomena was about getting people to kind of pick up this idea that there's some insider like feeding secret information to people and kind of running with it. And so in some way, it kind of feels like QAnon's always been sort of cannon fodder, right? That's, yeah. You know, and that kind of begs the question, which is, you know, we briefly touched on this before the show, before we started recording, but this sort of begs the question of, you know, we have the mainstream Republican Party, which for a lot of years was sort of the William F. Buckley Party, right? It was kind of well-educated, patrician, mostly attorneys, right? Relatively wealthy, almost entirely white, kind of running the party and sort of using various tactics to get people to come out and vote, right? Reagan's embrace of the religious right, for example, the Southern strategy, right? These sorts of techniques that they use to call people out to sort of vote for them, sort of contrary to what their economic interests were. But at the same time, that whole vision was held up by the notion that the people that were at the top of that chain were sort of above all of that, right? I think we saw that kind of switch a bit during the Tea Party, where sort of the on-the-ground grassroots activists kind of took control of that inertia a bit. And we're seeing something similar now. But I guess the question is, it seems like QAnon is a liability to the mainstream Republican Party, right? If you look at the response to Marjorie Taylor Greene, for example, right? Like, her approval rating was, what, 24% or something like that when recent polling was taken. Now, granted, 30% of people didn't know who she was, but that's still a really, really pretty terrible, pretty dismal approval rating, right? At the same time, the far right, you take groups like the Oath Keepers and the militia movement's one thing, but you take groups like the Vinlander Social Club, right? Neo-Nazi skinhead groups, the Hammerskins, right? Groups that have been around for a long time. They don't see themselves as conspiracy theorists, right? They see themselves as very serious, you know, revolutionaries for the white race or whatever. And they tend to look down on people like Alex Jones, but they're using these people. So where is that future, right? Why are these circles embracing these people? And at what point do you think they're going to get jettisoned, and what's going to happen at that juncture when all of a sudden QAnon isn't useful?
Yeah, that's tough to see. You know, I think that the Republicans, obviously they have a lot of use for QAnon, because these are people who are highly politically active, and they probably are very willing to part with their money. So, I mean, you know, even if you are establishment GOP, you want the constantly online people to root for your cause and to vote for you and to give you cash when you need it. That's useful, even if you don't want an extremist incident to happen. That's just the facts of the matter. I think the mainstream GOP, I think they're still kind of trying to ride the dragon a little bit in the sense that it's like, for example, a minority leader McCarthy came out and said that there's no room in the GOP for QAnon. He said this on Fox News. In terms of Marjorie Taylor Greene, why are you accepting Marjorie Taylor Greene? He said, don't worry, she has renounced QAnon. So mainstream respectable Republicans, we are not the QAnon party. Don't you worry. But at the same time, there doesn't seem to be a lot of energy behind trying to push QAnon out of it. I mean, there was last year that resolution denouncing QAnon, which was overwhelmingly voted for, except for 17 Republicans, interestingly enough. I think the mainstream Republicans, they still think that they can sort of contain the QAnon people, keep them at a distance, try and still use them for votes and money without, like, they're not going to call them out directly or anything like that. And hopefully they won't turn into a mass casualty incident when the worms are QAnon. I think that's really their strategy, trying to keep that balance where they're still encouraging enough so they're still useful, but not, you know, encourage them so much that a lot of people die because of them.
Well, and I think you hit on earlier when we were talking about why QAnon has kind of taken off, right? You hit on this concept of gamification, which I think is really, really, really critical to the whole Q phenomenon, right? This kind of rush to be the first person to say, oh, I noticed Donald Trump winking this certain way, so obviously that means that he's, like, you know, that whole phenomena. Now that Q is gone, where does that end, right? Because there is no real Q anymore. QAnon has become more or less an autonomous phenomena that's kind of driving itself forward based on any argument that seems to be consistent with the claims that were made prior without any verification, right? So at that point in which consistency becomes the only question, in theory, it could run forever. But where does that gamification, like, where does the sort of adrenaline boost of that gamification end, right? Because all games get boring eventually. Where does the political fiction stop being interesting, right? What does that look like? Or is that even possible, right? Or are we going to see, kind of like 9/11 conspiracy theories, we saw this slow bleed out of people over the course of 20 years, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, I don't know, I kind of question your premise in the idea that the game could eventually get boring. I mean, do you think when people post, you know, Do people get sick of getting a lot of likes when they post a really beautiful picture on Instagram? Mm-hmm. Do people get sick of retweets when they post a quip on Twitter or something like that? It's like, I think that, you know, if you want to take a, you know, if you view social media as a sort of a game to get engagement, people can engage with that game for many, many years, their entire lives, their entire careers. So I don't think it will really ever get sick. And you're right, even though Q hasn't posted since December 6th. I mean, technically, there have been longer silences from Q, so I wouldn't necessarily rule out Q posting again. Every time I've ever thought, perhaps Q will never post again, Q always proves me wrong by posting again. So it's still possible, but you're right. Q has been silent for a very long time. They're still generating new conspiracy theories. I mean, for example, a new popular one is that Biden isn't really in DC. He's actually at a movie lot at Castle Rock Studios in Culver City, and because they have a White House replica studio there, and this is where they're actually filming Biden because he's not really president. Now, this is a theory that became popular within the QAnon community. There are even videos on YouTube of conspiracy theorists trying to film outside of Castle Rock Studios and try to collect evidence of this. Yep. So this came, you know, organically within the QAnon community, and it is a narrative that took hold on multiple platforms. They don't need Q to tell them what to do. And in fact, if you look at the history of Q, how it usually worked was that the conspiracy theories that were promoted by Q were generated within the community first, but Q then amplify those conspiracy theories, and that caused it kind of canonized. I would say, you know, it has always been fueling in a way. So this is just sort of a continuation of that. So I really don't see any scenario in which they get sick of, you know, generating new conspiracy theories for fun. This is simply part of the process.
You're listening to It's Going Down, part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. Follow us online at itsgoingdown.org and on Twitter at @IGD_news. In order for It's Going Down to continue into the future, though, we need your support. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to sign up to donate monthly or give us a one-time donation. Again, go to itsgoingdown.org/shop and sign up to donate monthly or give us a one-time donation in order for us to grow our work into 2021. Thanks for listening. Let's get back to it. Have you seen, like, people leaving the QAnon movement, or like maybe like a dip in engagement in social media related to it since the 6th?
Well, there's been a huge dip in social media engagement since the 6th, mostly because the mainstream social media companies realized what QAnon was finally, and they have taken a historically aggressive stance on QAnon content on their platforms. They're very serious about it. I mean, I had a few dummy accounts on like Instagram, on Twitter that pretended to be QAnon, I got those were all my sort of my burner accounts were destroyed in the purge. So it seems like they got they got very, very serious. And even when I attempted to create new burner accounts to follow QAnon activity on Twitter, Twitter was very quick to destroy those as well. So it seems like they realize that they don't want to be party to a extremist movement that is capable of violence to the extent that QAnon is. I mean, this is nothing new. They've purged ISIS accounts. They've purged white nationalist accounts. They simply added QAnon to their no tolerance policy, it seems. They're still very much active. Like I said, we mentioned like Telegram is a popular hangout. There's also on Gab. Last I checked, the Great Awakening group on Gab had over 200,000 subscribers. They're going elsewhere, but they're still very much active.
Even though they've been deplatformed, there's no evidence that shows that, like, I don't know, there's been like a crisis of faith and people are leaving that current.
I think there actually is. I mean, there's individual stories that I've been talking to journalists, more people who have a long history of promoting QAnon are somehow free to feel more comfortable saying, you know what, whatever, I was duped. This shit sucks. I won't do this anymore, which is fantastic. But I would say this is a minority of the population, and the majority still seems to be quite active.
The practical question becomes, right? So, I mean, I definitely have had my sock puppet accounts nuked on all the platforms as well over the last like year or so. Given that they've been pushed off of the vast majority of spaces, people know where to find them. Where, if people want to try and actually figure out what's going on in this world, which seems very cryptic and sort of confusing, but if they want to sort of actually follow what's happening and do research on this, where are people going these days? I mean, Gab, obviously, but where else?
I still go to 8kun Q Research. This still seems to be the home base where QAnon followers are gathering. They're generating new conspiracy theories, as they always do. So you'll also see a lot of, white nationalist recruitment on every single Q Research thread. There's always someone posting a long anti-Semitic screed that uses a lot of anti-Semitic tropes on every single thread. It's been that way for years. So there's Q Research, there's Gab, there's Telegram. They're very active on Telegram. Those are the sort of the main places. I mean, some of the QAnon followers who've been booted from YouTube are now in places like Clout Hub. They use BitChute a little bit, but BitChute is an awful, awful platform. So even the QAnon followers complain about it, don't use it so much. But there are some on Clout Hub and some other platforms. I noticed actually there's one guy on Twitch who streams himself. He promotes QAnon stuff. He does okay for himself. He gets about 600 viewers at a time. They're everywhere that they can go.
Yeah, for sure. Wow. So there's I have a couple more questions specifically about tracing these networks. And then of course I have to ask the requisite who's Q question, obviously. Right. But sure. Let's start with tracing these networks out, right? So these networks seem, I mean, you mentioned in the Matrix, right, being kind of one of the nodes of this, right, and being sort of a person who organizes. And I think probably a lot of the listeners of this show are at least familiar with him, right?
Right.
But who are the figures, and what networks are they building? Are those networks sort of fragmenting up around individuals? Like, you know, Alex Jones denounced QAnon, but, you know, Alex Jones used to be one of these kind of condensation points for conspiracy, right? Are we seeing the rise of similarly prominent characters in Q world that might become the next sort of person with a radio show that gets 500,000 listeners a show? Or are we really looking at this like fragmented, sort of organic, more horizontal kind of crowdsourced conspiracy theory phenomenon, and that it's just going to stay this way?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it seems, I mean, there are prominent voices. There are prominent people who are still very, very active within the QAnon community. I'm like checking my list. There's one named Qtah. He's a QAnon follower from Utah who's very, very popular. There's a guy named CJ Truth who has a extremely popular Telegram channel. He used to have a popular Twitter page. There's Mel Q. There's Jordan Sather. Jordan Sather is a young guy. He used to be in the UFO disclosure stuff, moves over to Q. There's Redpill78, who's booted off of every platform, but still active on other. There's one called Inevitable ET, famously, I think had over two dozen banned accounts on Twitter before he finally gave up. So there's Truth Hammer. There's Julian's Rum. Julian's Rum used to troll me on Twitter, also got banned. There are a handful of people who simply, they're still trusted voices. I mean, it's one of those things where these people, they become, you know, they, because they are a little bit more articulate than the average QAnon follower, they're able to develop a following.
What about some of the old timers, people like Tracy Beans, right? Like people that have been out there from the very beginning. I've stopped hearing, I mean, the Watkins, obviously their name keeps coming up, right? But people like Tracy Beans have kind of, I don't want to say disappeared, but they're no longer like front and center in that radar for people that are kind of looking at it from the outside and aren't like in that world. What happened to all those people?
So Tracy Beans is still very active. She has a publication called Uncover DC, and she has a radio show called Light to Dark, funnily enough, even though it's not about QAnon. She seems to have basically stopped mentioning QAnon at all, but she still kind of carries on its basic sort of themes. In fact, I most recently saw Tracy Beans in a campaign advertisement for what's his name? Trump's former campaign photographer, he's basically running for mayor of Myrtle Beach, and so she was endorsing his campaign. So along with Juanita Broderick, the woman who famously credibly accused Bill Clinton of rape back in the 90s. I mean, so she's still very much active, but she seems to be someone who is basically grown out of Q. If she wanted basically a sort of a online media career, she seems to have accomplished that now without the Q baggage.
That I ever saw was a little buckskin pony mourning for her stall. The mama lay beside the fence under a tarp out in the rain. Peeking from the plastic was her honey-colored mane. I sat down on a water trough, wrung my hands and cried. Suppose we're all just animals with slightly different hides. I never got used to watching horses die. They die badly, it has kept me up at night. I never got used to watching horses die. Count my pretty ponies when I greet the morning light. Running on cooling summer day, feeling fine and frisky till a hole got in the way. The boss mare tore her shoulder, her stance was at a tilt. Now she's softly sleeping under the green alfalfa quilt. Granny Pruitt took his bobcat and buried her for me. The dead wagons turn around, how happy I should be. I never got used to watching horses die. They die badly, it has kept me up at night. I never got used to watching horses die. Count my pretty ponies when I greet the morning light. Minds get to starving once it snows. They'll wander off the mountaintop, they'll lick salt off of the roads. This little girl inside me is chomping at the bit. She cannot save them all, a truth hard to admit. I never got used to watching horses die. They die badly, it has kept me up at night. Got used to watching horses die. Count my pretty ponies when I greet the morning light. I never got used to watching horses die. Count my pretty ponies when I greet the morning light.
as I'm sure you're aware, after the storming of the Capitol, it seems like the neoliberal center has really sort of run with this narrative that extremism needs to be confronted, and it's kind of this blanket thing where it's like all extremism. And I mean, as we've documented on this program and, you know, on It's Going Down as a Platform and on this podcast many times, I mean, over the past, you know, 8 years, both under Obama and Trump, there's been a buildup directed at Black Lives Matter, against anti-fascists, the anarchist movement, more so than there has been the far right. In fact, you know, I would argue very straightforwardly that, you know, the Six was not only the outcome of a lot of far-right movements having years and years of basically talking about wanting to kill leftists and then kind of it boiling over into this, you know, as some media called it recently, the DC authoritarian zone, which I love. Not only that, but also just the police and the state, not only in some cases working with them, but basically giving them, you know, carte blanche to engage in organizing while they targeted left-wing and autonomous movements from below. So I'm just curious your thoughts on this talk of kind of doubling down and, you know, going after, quote, extremism, both online and in the real world, but also creating even new domestic terrorism laws, which we feel would be very much, you know, aimed at the left more so than anything on the right.
Yeah, I totally share your concerns. I think that giving the government more ability to engage in domestic surveillance or even expanding their law enforcement powers in an effort to combat domestic extremism, I think would almost certainly be abused. And this is simply, something you can learn from quite recent history, even in the, you know, the 20th century. So yeah, that would be really, really bad. When we're talking about like a sort of anti-extremism policy, I mean, I think that there are things that you could do that would be positive and would have a good impact on the problem without, you know, hurting anyone's domestic civil rights or sort of breaking up anyone who is skeptical of the government in any capacity. One thing that we've talked a lot about is like, you know, treating our veterans a little bit better. Number one, by creating fewer veterans, by, you know, having fewer unnecessary wars. But also giving them more support as they transition to civilian life, like Ashley Babbitt, who is a QAnon follower. She was a 14-year veteran of the Air Force, and she really struggled in civilian life. And she was a security guard. She ran a financially unsuccessful pool cleaning company, and she found QAnon. I can't help to think that if she had better support, then she may have never found QAnon, may have never went to DC, might still be alive. And I think a lot about this when I see how many extremists are veterans themselves. Yeah. I feel like if you simply stop the incentives for these veterans to become extremists, which I would argue that, you know, that the federal government has a responsibility to do, you could do a big chunk, you could do a big part towards decreasing the extremist threat without hurting anyone's civil rights.
There was recently an article that came out that broke down the kind of class dynamics and the various jobs that the people that attended the attempted coup at the Capitol were engaged in. Lots of police officers, a lot of small business owners, ex-military, sort of, you know, the classic kind of breakdown, people that have been declassed or feel threatened. You know, kind of the same components that made up past fascist movements. I'm just curious, you know, looking at these kind of breakdowns, what does this say about the people that are becoming animated and excited about things like QAnon?
I mean, you know, I think a lot of it comes from it's an instant way to get a dramatic purpose in life. I mean, these QAnon followers, what often draws them in is that they allow them all of a sudden they think they're changing the world in a dramatic way simply by sitting at their computer and and sharing memes and doing Q research and stuff. And I think that what that speaks to is that it speaks to a sincere desire to have some kind of impact. and to make I mean, even though they're often their end goals are often brutal, they often imagine themselves creating a fair, more equitable, more peaceful world. But I think that if there's a way to sort of satisfy that desire in a more productive way, perhaps even a more local way, then all of a sudden QAnon wouldn't be as appealing anymore.
Yeah, well, and I mean, I think that touches on a really important mechanism of intervention, right? Mm-hmm. What are the other mechanisms? So that kind of a mechanism that's sort of giving an alternative, right? I mean, this was something that a lot of us worked on sort of around the Iraq War, especially as the first round of soldiers were coming home. And there were a lot of them were our friends, and they had drug addiction issues and struggling with PTSD. And one of the things that we found in those initiatives, some of which were more organized than others, was the problem is just so massive. It's so huge that trying to imagine having those kinds of interventions at scale from a grassroots perspective becomes difficult, right? And of course, it opened up the question of other routes of intervention, right? So on top of doing those kinds of things, what are other routes that people can sort of utilize to try and disrupt, understand, even just research what is going on, right? I mean, if we want to really, if there is a route of intervention, there might not be outside of just diversion, right? Into something more productive.
Yeah. That, and also I would argue, I mean, getting away from the computer. I mean, I think a lot of it is. I think we saw this in the Q Shaman, who was very much a radical right up until he spent a few nights in jail, and all of a sudden he's blaming Trump allegedly. He's saying that he's renouncing QAnon. I think this is part of the fact that it's like, listen, I mean, like a lot of this is like having, you know, your cult leader in your pocket all the time, and is very, very difficult to break away from a movement where you're just constantly getting social reinforcement every day, instantly, wherever you are, that what you're doing is good. It's just simply psychologically extremely difficult to break away from it unless it's done by force, like, for example, spending a few nights in prison, I think that again, we need to find, you know, this, I suppose this is the same thing. It's the same kind of intervention stuff, but yeah, just having a vision of something else is like these radical, when people get radicalized, it is an expression of a need that is not being met elsewhere. I guess the broad question is, how exactly do we encourage people to satisfy these needs in a really more productive, more peaceful way?
Well, and I think it kind of brings up this question that a lot of people have been asking, which is not sort of a big scale question, but a really small one, which is that a lot of families have been ripped apart by this, right? Just torn completely to shreds. I mean, I've lost at least one family member to this too. Family members to this. Almost everyone I know has lost at least somebody, right? That they just will not communicate with anymore. It's just too much. But at some point, the question has arisen, what do we do in that context, right? How do we, if we can, reestablish relationships with people without falling into this sort of platitude about unity, which absolves them of accountability, right? How do we sort of allow accountability to occur in this context, which is necessary, while still without driving those people further and further and further into that echo chamber?
It really is. I mean, sometimes as extremism researchers often are, they're accused of being too sympathetic to the subjects that they research, and that's something I definitely understand. And of course, our primary motivations or primary sympathies should be with the kinds of groups that these extremist movements target. And so I should, of course, never forget that. But at the same time, you know, there's really no accountability is fine, but But, you know, just as a pragmatic matter, these are just assholes we still have to live with one way or another. and so we need to find a realistic way to live alongside them without them killing us or us killing them, preferably. Yeah. And if that means treating real pieces of shit with a little bit more kindness than they deserve, I think that's something that I can personally do. I don't expect other people to do it. I understand why, especially if they're they want to eliminate your existence because of what you look like. I get that. But at the same time, I think it involves a more empathy than more people realize. You know, it reminds me of a little bit of in Buddhism, there's this meditation practice called loving kindness, and yes. the idea is that you first develop loving kindness for yourself, and then it extends outwards towards your immediate family members, and then other people, acquaintances, business associates, and then strangers at the street. But the highest level of loving kindness meditation is supposed to be the difficult person. I think this requires those of us who are, I guess, a little bit more connected to reality to try and exercise extremely high levels of loving kindness meditation for these real pieces of shit who really need to reflect on why they're so in love with these hateful ideologies. Like I said, I don't have an easy solution for you, but that's how I think about it.
Well, and that's, I mean, we've been talking on the show for the last 3 or 4 weeks about how since January 6th, there's been this uptick in, just like, let's just say it this way, liberals, right? Just like moderate liberals, like all of a sudden, like hunting Nazis down on the internet, like getting people fired from their jobs. And like, all of that's great. But one of the things that we've been talking a lot about is this necessity to understand the adversary, right? To grasp what's going on with them, both organizationally, but also as humans, right? And really starting to dig those threads out as much as we can with as much detail as possible as a way to sort of understand the best ways to combat what's happening here, right? And I guess the question is, how is that calculus going to change, right? Like we're watching, how did the Washington Post put it? They said that there's this great realignment happening in American politics right now, right? Thousands of people are dropping out of the GOP. You've got people joining the GOP. You've got people joining the DNC. You've got people dropping out of all of it. You've definitely seen an uptick in anti-fascist activity. Like everything feels like it's in flux. How in these sorts of moments, do you think that people can start to even just enter trying to understand things when they're so in flux right now?
I don't know. I'm still struggling to kind of understand it myself. I am sometimes, like I mentioned before the interview, I am in some sense kind of politically naive, in the sense that I was very naive to believe when I first started researching QAnon in the middle of 2018 that it would become a mainstream thing. And I was naive to believe that the Republicans would, the establishment Republicans at least, would have no tolerance for QAnon on their ranks. It was unimaginable that a QAnon follower would ascend to Congress when I first started researching this stuff. The only thing I can really do is that try and sort of observe exactly how this realignment settles, whatever it is settles and whatever becomes our new political reality, and react to that. And that's all I can do, honestly.
You know, in the 90s, as people like Spencer Sunshine have pointed out, there was a rise in kind of like what some people have referred to as like quote unquote harmless conspiracy theories. Like, you know, the X-Files got really popular, or, you know, nerding out about cryptids, or, you know, watching some like guy hide out in the woods waiting to find Bigfoot or something. You know, I was just looking at some of the free streaming channels that come with the Roku I just bought. And, you know, it's like all like really bad B movies and like a lot of horror stuff. But there's always like a bunch of documentaries, and like half of them are like ancient aliens, reptilian race, sort of, you know, retrograde anti-Semitic repackaged conspiracy. I'm just curious, like, have decades of this stuff like primed us for where we are now. Like, if you grew up watching Ancient Aliens, like, on the History Channel, and now you're, like, looking at QAnon, you're like, oh, yeah, this makes sense.
You know, that's a tough one. Honestly, I don't know if I would blame general broad interest in conspiracy theories in pop culture for the rise of this kind of like far right extremism. Because, you know, broadly, I think conspiracy theories, number one, they're stories. You can't stop human beings from being interested in exciting stories. So that's just that's simply the way we'll always function. The other thing is that I think that, conspiracies, are interesting. And I think that, I mean, my big beef is that not that QAnon followers, develop theories about what powerful people are up to, is that they do it in a really terrible, unproductive way. I think that, conspiracy theorizing broadly, if you're developing a theory about the ways in which powerful people are coming together and finding ways to consolidate their power, I think this is a healthy, productive process. That's in fact essential for any political system, including and especially democracy. I don't think there's anything wrong with like engaging political conspiracy theories as stories. I don't think there's anything wrong with speculating what the powers that be are up to. I think the risk is more like, not being able to tell the difference between an X-Files Monster of the Week storyline and real life. I mean, that's really, I think, the problem more than anything else. I think it's really more anything else, an invitation to, an analysis that's a little bit more based in reality.
I have to ask the requisite question. Jake Hanrahan did Q clearance, right? Yeah. And there's kind of a cottage industry that's built up around identifying who Q is, right? And of course, I've got my theories, but, there's the Paul Ferber theory, right? There's the kind of, there was Insider Anon, Paul Ferber kind of popped up. For those of you that don't know, Insider Anon was kind of a phenomenon on the Chan boards in which you had like FBI Anon and White House Anon, and I forgot the total. Someone took a count. There were like a few hundred of them just on 4chan alone. And then even more on, 8chan, all these other 420chan has a whole bunch of them, right, that have kind of circulated over time. But I guess the questions that circulate around that for myself are, obviously, A, who do you think is behind person or people behind Q? And how has that evolved over time? Because clearly there's been an evolution. There's been a change, right, in language set and, vocabulary and style. But also why, right? So, like, you take someone like Paul Ferber, who's a conspiracy theorist, and the why makes sense, except he would be the one generating the conspiracy that he then also believes in. And so there's kind of a question mark there. But for the Watkins, the other big theory is Ron and Jim Watkins, and they're not particularly political people. So what is going on? Who do you think is Q? Is it a group? Is it an individual? Why are they doing this? Like, what's the grift, essentially? Like, what's going on here?
You mentioned the theory that involves that this was something that that QAnon was sparked by Paul Ferber, the South African, who's a conspiracy theorist. I think that it's certainly plausible. This conspiracy theory movement was sort of carried forth by Patriot Soapbox, by someone who goes by the name of Pamphlet Anon, who's been named as someone who's possibly deeply involved in QAnon. But then it was later seemed to be taken over by the Watkins. I think that if you look at sort of Jim Watkins' history, he created his own kind of like news source called the Goldwater. It was very amateurish and very conspiratorial content. And a lot of the content prior to Q, it sounded like QAnon stuff about, Satanists and hating Hillary Clinton and this kind of stuff. Sometimes he would hire Filipino women to read these things. And it was clear English was not their first language, and they would read these sort of scripts for videos for the Goldwater. But it seems as though he had an interest in developing a kind of online media empire. And we saw this in the Goldwater. So it would be in line with, it seems, with of his interest if he wanted to be, I guess, the Rupert Murdoch of online conspiracy theories. He wanted to control the ultimate source of this big conspiratorial movement, which he could then, use to maybe connect with other conspiracy theorists. Promote whatever they thought was very important. I'm not sure what kind of deals are being involved behind the scenes. I mean, it was revealed that Watkins was constantly communicating with a lot of big QAnon promoters like Neon Revolt and other people. So it seems to be some kind of elaborate grift of some kind.
Mm-hmm. And do you see them? So if this is the Watkins, right? I mean, we saw Ron Watkins sort of very spectacularly on Twitter announced that he was, quitting 8chan and moving out of the Philippines and going to Japan. And then he pops up like 2 months later as the source for Sidney Powell's Kraken lawsuits, specifically talking about the Dominion voting systems thing. And if it would follow that, if that theory is correct, that that might be his escape route potentially. But how do these people get out from under this? Or do they? Do they just vanish into the ether and just kind of let it do its thing, or are they going to try and pull out from under this? Like, what's going to happen to the actual grifters, like the people that organize this thing?
Yeah, that is a big question. Yeah, I know that Dominion Voting Systems listed Jim and Ron Watkins as possible targets for their ongoing sort of legal efforts, suing people who they believe defamed them. So that would be very interesting if there wound up being actual consequences for spreading false conspiracy theories. It seems like at the moment they're mostly interested in laying low. I mean, Jim Watkins is technically still producing these weird videos. I'm not sure where he's based anymore, but Ron Watkins has been gone totally silent. He left the kind of like, oh, well, but I guess I'm moving on from that kind of message, which is very strange. They seem to shy away, at least Ron Watkins has shied away from the limelight at the moment. And there are no more Q drops. So, I mean, perhaps they are simply laying low and waiting for sort of the intense scrutiny into their activities to die down.
You know, just to leave on a positive note, like, what are some things that you've seen that have caused people to walk away from this political subculture?
One thing that actually happened was that the moving the goalpost to March 4th from January 20th as the true day of the inauguration, this was too much for a few QAnon followers. They realized, once they actually saw Biden in office, this was too much for them. They were out. I mean, sometimes people really do reach their threshold. It doesn't happen that often. But it does happen. Other things were like, sometimes I spoke to one person who saw that, who said that, they didn't like the way that Q was using Bible codes or something. And they thought that no military operation would, sort of use the Bible in this way. I'm not sure, but sometimes it is like a little thing that they're sort of perhaps familiar with, that they sort of realize that something doesn't quite smell right, and this causes them to get away from it. I mean, the thing is that one thing is important to remember is that getting out of QAnon isn't always necessarily a good thing, because sometimes it can lead into, like we mentioned, different kind of extremism. There's one case, there's a QAnon influencer named Dylan Wheeler who went by the name Education for Libs on Twitter and Instagram. He kind of left QAnon for really a kind of Christian identity movement kind of thing. When he became a little bit more anti-Semitic, he started blaming Jews for 9/11. So he wasn't a QAnon follower anymore. Very much denounced QAnon, but he kind of rolled into something arguably even worse and more dangerous. The thing is that even if you got all these people to stop following QAnon, that mindset that they have, that's very conspiratorial and paranoid and perhaps worried about losing their place in the world or whatever the hell is driving them, it's going to remain, and they're going to fill that they're going to satisfy that feeling, that kind of anxiety, with something else, even if it's not QAnon.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. We really appreciate it. Anything you want to plug right now or tell people where they can follow your work?
Yeah. You can follow me just type in QAnon Anonymous into your favorite podcasting app. You can also follow me on Twitter. That's @Travis_view.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.